few weeks ago, I put up a bird feeder behind the offices here at church. I was prompted by some conversations with Ruth and Tom Little and by a packet of field guides dropped off by Francie Barnes. That literature had been lying on my desk for a few weeks even before this, calling me to make use of it. And as you know, there is an edge of woods along the back of the church just out the window. Edge environments are perfect for feeding birds. They hold the most diversity. They are where all the life is. So one day in mid-December, I made a trip to the feed store for supplies. I set up a pole and a feeder in the freezing ground, filled the wire basket with sunflower seeds, fitted the whole thing with a squirrel baffle, went back inside to watch and wait. And wait, and wait. Thinking unrealistically that we would have an explosion of birds within the first few minutes, I was set back by the apparent lack of interest. Maybe this would take a day, I thought, and then it took another day, and another day. And after about a week of this, of no activity, I told the others in the office that maybe we needed to put up a sign, free food. No creed, salvation for all. We are a welcoming congregation, something like that. And someone suggested I send out a tweet. This went on, this lack of anything, for a full 2 weeks, even after the first snow, even after the cold snap. And then one Monday, I came in to see two chickadees flitting back and forth from the edge of the woods to the feeder, taking one seed with them at a time back to the safety of the tree. Not very efficient, we thought, but it was a start. In not too long, a cardinal joined them, and then about 10 a.m., guess what? Juncos? Blue jays? Woodpeckers? Nope. A white-tailed deer, a six-point buck up from the woods to nibble at the feeder. I mentioned this the next day to Dave Schubert, who heads up buildings and grounds, and he said, you know what that means. It means we're going to have to start feeding them too. So off to the feed store, this time for corn. Since then, we have had a full riot of birds at the feeder, and every night there's a little ruckus back where I've spread the corn. We've counted at least five deer, two bucks, a doe, and her two yearlings. I expect we will have more as the winter drags on. Maybe some turkeys, maybe a fox will come to investigate, or a falcon. We have been waiting all through December. Wait was our theme for the month. We began on the first Sunday with Matthew, offering some lessons in patience. Words from Lao Tzu, every journey begins at your feet. December was a month of Advent, too, a time of expecting. The choir graced us with a beautiful version of the Magnificat, that song of Mary sung to her cousin Ruth, mother of John the Baptist, when they both were pregnant. Matthew spoke again on waiting for the world to change, and our small groups have been talking about things worth waiting for or not for the entire month. But the year is turning now. This is the day before the last day of the year. The word has gotten out. The time of anticipation is rapidly coming to an end. Things are changing, and sometimes that's an uneasy feeling. There is a word for this. It fits this time of the year. The word is liminality. It comes from the Latin word for threshold. In modern use, liminality comes from anthropology, from the study of ritual in small societies. In anthropology, it refers to the ambiguity, the disorientation that occurs in the middle stage of rituals, when participants no longer hold their pre-ritual status, but have not yet begun the transition to the status they will hold when the ritual is complete. Not still one thing, not yet another. Think about coming of age rituals. Think about them applied to any age, to any change, not just physical change, but emotional, spiritual, intellectual change. That's what this is about. Of course, you are always something. That's precisely what makes these liminal stages so unnerving, because all that stuff that lies below the surface, the subliminal stuff, all that's coming out. During a ritual's liminal stage, participants stand at the threshold. They stand between how they used to find their identity, their time, or their community, and a new way, the way in which the ritual moves them. There is a broader sense of liminality, too. It can be any time when things are turning. It is that point of change. How far can a dog run into the woods? Well, halfway, of course. After that, he's running out. During liminal periods, social order is upended or even dissolved. Tradition disappears, things once taken for granted may be thrown into doubt. Think about 9/11, or an election, or the fiscal cliff. Liminality is fluid, it's malleable. Liminality is that momentary space in between, the time when the sun stands still, the time of change, not still one thing, not yet another. Liminality, I think, too, describes edge environments, the intersection between the field and the woods. Edge environments are rich with potential. They harbor the most diversity. They are where all the life is. Today, we are in such a liminal time. We are in an edge environment. Today, it is almost not 2013, not yet 2014. A week ago Saturday, we celebrated the solstice, the time when the sun stands still, when the length of days begins to grow. Today, we are invited to hear ancient stirrings, to be compelled to find ourselves rich with potential. We are invited into a bit of danger, too, into liminality in our own ritual, a ritual of change and growth. In the past few weeks, you might have had a chance to hear or see or at least remember a bit of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol. And so maybe you have had a chance to consider your own ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. Dickens lived and worked at the same time as several luminaries from our own religious story, William Ellery Channing, Margaret Fuller, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Among the turning points then was an idea that came into currency as salvation by character. Salvation by character, like a lot of church controversy, actually wasn't a new idea. In fact, the church had been wrestling with this for a long time. The question was whether salvation, classically understood as salvation into eternal life, was solely and purely and undeservedly a gift from God, or, on the other hand, whether there was something we could do, something we should do to make us worthy of such a gift. Do our good deeds, our works, do they count for anything? No, we are saved by grace through faith alone, came the church's answer. And worse, we are a miserable lot, born bad, destined to stay bad. And then in the early 1800s came these folks like Dickens and Channing with a far more optimistic view. Then, in that liminal time, following the Enlightenment, yet not yet to the Industrial Revolution, after the Revolutionary War, and in the middle of the Romantic period of literature, the great potential of humanity was blooming. Character was seen as far more than just doing good works. Character became an increasing fulfillment of potential. In old language, it was achieving likeness to God. In later modern language, we might understand it as self-actualization. For these 19th century thinkers, it was salvation by character. Character as the full embodiment of who we are capable of becoming, as becoming who we really are, who we might be. And salvation, likewise, not so much as a ticket to the afterlife, but as redemption here and now in this world with ourselves, with others, with what matters most. You know that we have never been into creeds, and this never became one either. But James Freeman Clarke, in the mid-19th century, gave voice to principles that shaped Unitarianism well into the 20th century. You have to pardon the patriarchal language. He says, "We believe in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Jesus, salvation by character, and the progress of mankind onward and upward forever and ever." 100 years later, John Lennon sings, "You've got to admit, it's getting better, better all the time." We've pretty much debunked onward and upward by now. There is still so much to be done. Headlines just from this week: election violence in Thailand, insurgency in Iraq, graft in Turkey, and of course, the ever-increasing disparity between the rich and the poor in this country. People in need, people without homes, people losing their homes. The woods behind this church harbor not just deer and sparrows, but a homeless camp. What to do? How to respond? As always, the journey begins at your feet. The first step starts here. It starts now. It starts with each one of us. Reverend Kendall Gibbons writes, "We are here because we are people of faith. Within each of us lives the conviction of a saving faith that could restore our broken planet and illuminate the lives of our sisters and brothers. Ancient wisdom teaches that we who would save the world must first save ourselves. We who would restore the planet must learn to restore the broken structures of the institutions closest to hand, to illuminate the lives of our companions and our friends. To this end, let us center ourselves, acknowledging the trouble of mind and vexation of spirit that accompany us even here. Let us open ourselves to that creative mystery which is at work in our striving, whose servants we seek to be." Dickens's lesson is that radical transformation is possible, possible even for a guy like Scrooge. And if Scrooge can do it, why not you and me? Indeed, in this way, Dickens makes change not just possible, but imperative. If Scrooge can do it, then why not you and me? We all are made up of stories we tell to ourselves, the stories of our past, the stories of our future. We usually understand how our past stories, the events of our lives, shape who we are today. We all go through some school of hard knocks. But it is our future stories that are no less important. What we tell ourselves about our hopes and dreams, about who we imagine ourselves to be, these things are every bit as real as our memories. We would do well to pay attention to them. Our own ghosts of Christmas future need not be frightening. They can allow us to shape the present in such a way as to achieve likeness to God, fulfillment, self-actualization, right relationship. What is required is a little resolve. It is, of course, that time of year. In your order of service is a strip of paper. If you do not find one, or if you need a pencil, the ushers will help you now, I think. But think about that strip of paper as a continuum. One end represents your ghost of Christmas past. The other end is your future story, your becoming. As this service continues, I invite you to consider something that is holding you back, some part of the story you tell yourself that you know limits your potential, something you can stop waiting for, something that you would give up. Write that down on one end of the paper. Then think about something that you would like to move into, some potential, some step toward greater fulfillment. Write that down on the other end. When you're ready, tear the paper in half. The end with potential you can keep. Take it home with you, put it on your refrigerator, or find some other way of hanging on to it that allows it to become part of your story. The other part, the part that's holding you back, well, hang on to it for a few minutes yet. Think about it. Understand what it means to live without this thing. Giving up things is hard, even things that are sometimes painful. In a few minutes, I'll invite you to come forward, drop the paper into the flame, which we will light right here, and let that part of it go. Leave it here to fade into the past. But before we get there, please join me in a responsive reading.